The voters approved Issue 1 on the November ballot, codifying abortion rights and reproductive health freedoms into the state constitution. But implementing the vote of the people is proving to be contentious, especially from Republican lawmakers in the state house who are strongly opposed to the passage of the constitutional amendment. We'll talk to State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler to start today's show. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Karen will tell us about a draft bill that suggested removing the courts from the process of putting Issue 1 into place. Later, we'll discuss pre-exposure, prophylaxis, or PrEP treatments. Medical professionals say that universal PrEP treatments could end the transmission of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. We'll get to those topics, and we welcome your input via phone or email in a few minutes. First, the latest national and local news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been a week since voters approved Issue 1 in the November election. Voters approved the constitutional amendment with nearly 57% of the vote. The amendment will codify abortion protections and reproductive health freedoms into the state's founding document. The issue passed despite strong opposition from Republican state lawmakers. From the moment Issue 1 passed, there has been defiance from some lawmakers vowing to still fight against abortion rights in the state. Last week, a group of Republican lawmakers suggested taking the courts out of the process when it comes to deciding which existing abortion restrictions on the books are impacted by the passage of the amendment. Joining me now to talk about what's happening at the State House when it comes to implementing Issue 1, I'm joined by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Karen, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
And if you'd like to join the conversation or have a thought or a question for Karen, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. Karen, let's start with how an amendment is implemented when it potentially changes existing laws on the books. How should that work?
Well, the amendment does not automatically change any laws. What it does is set a standard for courts to review those laws and for people to bring suits based on this new constitutional amendment over existing laws. So, for instance, Democrats have proposed a package of legislation that would overturn some laws that they say are now unconstitutional when it comes to Issue 1, the constitutional amendment on abortion access and reproductive rights. And some examples of the things that they've proposed to get rid of the laws are the 24-hour waiting period and certain laws that are called they're called trap laws. There are laws that are specifically designed to pick away at what abortion providers can and can't do. And a lot of these things were even put into state budgets. So then Republicans had said they were going to come up with their own package of proposals. We haven't seen that yet. But then there was this draft bill that was circulated over the last couple of days, which Speaker Jason Stevens says is not going to go anywhere. But it suggested that in the implementation of Issue 1, that state lawmakers take control of the process and take it out of the judiciary, which is not how things work. The laws are decided by the judiciary according to the Constitution.
Yeah, but I think for, you know, the public out there, you hear this and kind of in your head, if you're thinking about it, you're like, that doesn't sound right. But it's not a constitutional move is what you're saying. And I think from constitutional experts that have been talked to about this, it just does not pass muster. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I talked to two specific legal expert Stephen Steinglass, who's the Dean Emeritus at Cleveland State's College of Law. And he said this was more extreme than he had expected, this proposal to basically allow the lawmakers to have exclusive authority over implementing Issue 1 and withdraw all that authority from courts, the judiciary, all that. And then another legal expert I talked to, Mark Weaver, who taught constitutional law. He was a former deputy attorney general. He's on the pro-life side. And he even said that this is, if that's what they were talking about in this proposal, to take away the power of the courts completely in this, then that the Constitution provides the power to the courts to decide these laws. Of course, like I said, Speaker Jason Stevens has said this is not going to go anywhere. He called it schoolhouse rock type stuff, referencing the series that we watched as kids about how a bill becomes law and things like that. But the idea that you know, there is a system of government, there are three branches of government, each branch of government has a particular role to play, and judges and the judiciary have the role of looking at laws and deciding whether they are constitutional or not.
And actually, I'd love to hear from Mark Weaver. We have a cut of your interview with that former deputy attorney general, longtime Republican consultant, when he talked about this attempt and the fact that it's likely not going to work.
The devil will be in the details because we don't have a piece of legislation to read. But if their goal is to remove jurisdiction over the Constitution from the Supreme Court, the state constitution doesn't allow it.
So, Karen, I mean, what does this say about, you know, 7 days out of the November 7th election and some GOP lawmakers, you know, even introducing something like this that kind of puts to question who has, you know, authority and kind of, you know, even questioning the separation of powers that you know, are so enshrined in our state and national government. I mean, there's a bit of an audacity to that. And what do you think that says about where those Republican lawmakers are standing about this issue?
Well, the proposal was never formally introduced. It was just a draft. And,
okay.
And Weaver, that's Weaver's point there, is that there was no actual piece of legislation, but certainly the intent was to carry this forward. And what I think is interesting here is that this exact idea was posted in a statement on OhioHouse.gov under the Republicans news section. So this is the official state house government website for the House, and this proposal, this idea of taking control over the implementation of Issue 1 out of the courts and putting it in the hands of state lawmakers, and of course, a majority of state lawmakers are Republican, that was posted on the Ohio House's website,
right,
which takes it from a level of, you know, there were only four Republicans who were initially floating this idea in an email that came out over the weekend from a far-right conservative Christian group. But this, it feels like, takes it to a different level in terms of putting some gravitas behind it.
Sure.
But of course, like I said, Speaker Jason Stevens says we're not going to do that. And he seems to be suggesting that indeed the courts will be deciding on Issue 1 and the implementation of it, which is how the process pretty much works. But he's kind of pushing back in the way that would be typical. Now, another thing that I think is very interesting is the idea of taking this out of the hands of the judiciary.
Right.
I mean, the judiciary in Ohio, the top court, is the Ohio Supreme Court. And there are four Republicans and three Democrats. The four Republicans on the Ohio Supreme Court have all been very public about their anti-abortion views. So it seems like the Supreme Court is going to be sympathetic to some of the cases that specifically involve abortion law.
If you'd like to join the conversation or you have a question or a thought you want to share with Karen or I, you can call 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. Let's go ahead and welcome Dan onto the show. He's calling in from Lakewood. Dan, go ahead. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I just have a quick comment. I was involved in the gerrymandering stuff a couple of years ago and ended up in one of those meetings with the governor and everything where we had passed by 70% and it had been voted on, and they basically looked at us and said, we're not going to do it. And this feels like another time where they're really just disregarding the voters. It's starting to make me sad that people who I believe my tax dollars paid for their job are feeling more and more emboldened to just disregard what voters want. And that's it.
Dan, I appreciate that. And I know you're not alone in that sentiment. We have an email from Chris in Menor who says, what Republican legislators are trying to do regarding the constitutional amendment guaranteeing reproductive freedom, rather, is not just going against the will of the people. They're scheming to attack the very foundation of our democracy, the system of checks and balances, and the sanctity of the state constitution. Karen, How, from your vantage point, do you see kind of these moves being made, at least, you know, even if they have legs or not, but you say, you know, they're appearing on official websites of the legislature as something that even is introduced? How is that kind of generating animus on the electorate and people who are saying, you know, how can we go and vote on something and then, you know, within a week hear that there's, you know, any sorts of efforts to defy that?
Well, and I think that that is one thing that is concerning, of course, to people who are trying to put forward the next redistricting amendment. There is a group that is led by former Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor and former Justice Yvette McGee Brown, and that's a Republican and a Democrat leading that group called Citizens Not Politicians. They're putting forward a proposal to take redistricting away from the elected politicians, the seven who sit on that panel, and make it a 15-member citizens commission, which would be made up of an even number of Republicans, Democrats, and independents. They're very concerned, and they say that this is exactly why they feel that they need to move forward. What's happening here is showing that the system needs to change. And like I said, I think, you know, some of these ideas about taking control away from the judiciary, things like that, these would be ideas that I think typically had been in the far right conservative or the extreme areas of activism. And now it seems like they're moving forward a little bit. And I know for some people that's very concerning. At least we do have the knowledge now that Speaker Jason Stevens has said it's not going to go forward. But certainly the idea that it even came about, I think, would give people pause, because it is not how it's supposed to work. Lawmakers who are partisan politicians, as are many judges, are not supposed to be making decisions on laws. That is what judges are supposed to do.
We got an email from David, Karen, that says, I don't remember when I voted for issue one, whether there was a date with which it becomes the law of the state. However, whatever the Ohio legislature does to go against the will of the people, I would think that healthcare workers should be able to rest easier knowing that whatever happens, they could protect themselves against any legal challenges they might face. How do you respond to that?
Well, and that's it. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be legal challenges. And that's where Stevens has said that this is going to lie, not in the hands of a Republican who drafted this bill and the Republicans who supported it. It's going to lie in the courts. The implementation of issue one, I mean, the constitutional amendment created by issue one is a constitutional amendment. And then, of course, the implementation of that is the process of deciding what laws work under that constitutional amendment and what laws don't work. And, you know, one of the other things I would add here, too, is, and you referenced this in the beginning of the show, the pushback against the issue one vote. I mean, almost 57% of Ohioans voted for issue one, but almost immediately we saw a reaction from Senate President Matt Huffman saying this is going to start a revolving door of ballot campaigns on this issue. Jason Stevens that night said, we're going to do all we can to push back on this and, as he put it, protect life. Then you saw 26 Republicans comprise what's called the pro-life caucus, who said they are going to push back against any changes. So there's definitely resistance here in implementing issue one. How far that resistance goes, I mean, we've seen one lawmaker with a couple of other supporters moving forward in one direction, but it remains to be seen, I think. I think the courts are really going to be where it is, of course.
Yeah, and Karen, when you look at the map, I took a look at, you know, the issue one kind of voting map, and you know, there were a lot of counties where ultimately they said no to issue one. And so I think in some respects, these Republican lawmakers maybe do feel like they are representing some contingent that's not being protected. with issue one being passed.
Yeah, I want to add to that. 63 counties did reject issue one. And the counties where it passed are primarily, certainly the counties that President Biden won in 2020, but also 18 counties won by former President Trump. So there was fairly widespread support in big parts of the state. I think the other thing to remember here is that there's a lot of competition for the pro-life vote in this area. I mean, you've got Huffman, the president of the Senate, who's term limited there. He's going to run for the House. If he wins, he's likely to challenge Jason Stevens to become speaker. And they both speak to that constituency. And so I think that that's part of why you're seeing some of these people come forward. They're all going to be up for re-election next year. They're all working for that vote. And the struggle between Stevens and Huffman, I think, is going to be a big part of whatever happens if they both are elected.
Jackie's calling in from Akron this morning. Jackie, thanks for calling into the Sound of Ideas. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. So my name's Jackie. I'm a physician. I provide abortion care in Ohio and in California, where the landscape is quite different. And, you know, given the amazing work that was done on issue one and the way that voters across the country and in Ohio have voted in support of abortion access, I'm curious if you think this is going to be an issue that once again leaves the state, as the Supreme Court here is majority Republican and has voiced their anti-abortion sentiments. Is this going to be a thing that works somewhat against the Republicans by becoming an issue that was left to the state and then the state didn't trust the voters?
I don't know. I think it's too early to really get a sense of what this is going to mean for 2024. I think both parties are certainly going to be looking at the vote, not only from November 7th, but also the vote in August, which was when voters rejected the proposal to require 60% voter approval to amend the Constitution. I think those two issues spoke a lot, and of course you add in the legal marijuana in there too, spoke a lot about how voters view things when candidates aren't on the ballot. And so I don't know that it's fair to say that this is a sea change moment for Ohio. Ohio has been dominated by Republicans in terms of political wins for at least a decade, if going back even further than that. So I think it's hard to say, but certainly, at least nationally, abortion has become an issue that Democrats have really decided is important to campaign on, and it has not been a winner for Republicans.
Let's go ahead and take one more call from Margaret calling in from Cleveland. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning. My concern is that, you know, the voters have voted, they made their decision, and now the politicians are going to try to go against it, but they're going to use taxpayers' money to fight these issues legally. And is that fair?
And that's been a complaint, I think, all along, that all of these laws that were passed, I mean, every ban that was passed was challenged. The six-week ban, the ban on abortion after 6 weeks, was challenged immediately after it was signed and has been in court ever since it was signed in 2019. That's taxpayer money that was being used there just to defend those laws against lawsuits when you had Republican support. Now you've got Republicans who are opposed to the implementation of issue one. You're going to see more lawsuits and more court challenges. That's the way it's going to be. And it is unfortunate because taxpayers, I think, are getting frustrated with some of these things. I mean, just look at the August special election. It cost $18 million to run an election where 39% of voters turned out and soundly rejected a proposal to make it harder to amend the Constitution. And that $18 million was higher than what was the initial prediction for what the election would cost.
All right, Karen. A hot topic, and you are on it, and we appreciate all your work at the State House and, enlightening us and our listeners about what is going on when it comes to issue one and the moves being made in the legislature. So, Karen, I appreciate your time this morning. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, my team, Joe Ingles and Sarah Donaldson, we're staying on it. So thanks.
Absolutely. All right. Time now for a quick break. Coming up next, we discuss universal PrEP treatment and why some say this approach could end the transmission of the virus that caused AIDS. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. Since the 1980s, when the epidemic first began, AIDS, which is caused by the HIV virus, has taken the lives of 40 million people. But the days of HIV/AIDS meaning a death sentence are long gone. In fact, now medical professionals say that ending the transmission of HIV completely is medically possible with the universal treatment of a drug called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. And that's the case at Neighborhood Family Practice, a multi-location health center on Cleveland's West Side. Doctors, nurses, and staff are working towards that goal, and in addition to the other work they do. But they say there's some key steps that have to be taken to get to zero transmissions. And one of them, people need to get tested. So let's have a conversation about this, the effort to reduce HIV transmissions in our region and across the nation. Joining me to talk about this in studio is Dr. Lisa Navacruz, HIV primary care program doctor at Neighborhood Family Practice. Doctor, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. And Brittany Flory, an HIV prevention nurse at Neighborhood Family Practice. Brittany, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good morning to both of you. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you know someone or are someone who's used PrEP, uses it now, wants to share your experience, or if you have a question regarding, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideasroom.org or you can tweet us. We are at Sound of Ideas. So, Dr. Navacruz, there was a time when having HIV was incredibly dire, and it did mean a death sentence for a while, decades ago.
Decades.
And so, yeah, I'm not trying to conflate or make it seem like that's the case now, but I think a lot of kind of lay people who aren't as familiar will make that association of
right.
HIV, AIDS, and the epidemic that really, rained terror on our country and around the world. So can you describe what now the landscape looks like when it comes to how much of a threat HIV is and when that all changed? When AIDS became less of a threat?
So we have really benefited from the fact that there are amazing scientists pushing the treatment of this illness forward. And over the years, we have had classes after classes of medications that have come out that have made it so that folks who are living with HIV, if they stay engaged in care and they stay on treatment and we reach their treatment goals, their life expectancy is just about the same as anyone who is not living with HIV. But like we know with any chronic disease, staying engaged in care and staying on treatment despite all the other things that are going on in your life is really challenging. But one of the tools that we have found in that can lead us towards ending the HIV epidemic is that if we have those folks who are living with HIV on appropriate treatment and their viral loads are suppressed, their viral loads are so low that they cannot transmit HIV sexually to any other folks. So if we get folks to know their status, to engage in care, to get themselves treated, and we use the tool of PrEP to take care of folks who might be at risk of picking up HIV, we can stop this viral transmission. It's a whole new place that we've been at for the last several years.
So people with HIV can live and really thrive, live kind of until old age.
Absolutely. And have their full, wonderful lives with all of the things they want to do, including childbearing and being in healthy relationships.
And when you talk about treatments for people with HIV, are we specifically just talking about PrEP or is
No.
there a battery of drugs?
So PrEP is an antiretroviral medicine that we use for folks who are not infected. For folks who are infected, they get a cocktail of HIV drugs called antiretroviral therapy. And based on the patient and their particular medical issues, it's usually a combination of two or three drugs. We have once-a-day pills. We have shots that lots of people see on TV commercials and can be up to every 2 months. We really have reached a place where we can tailor the treatment to the patient so it works with their lifestyle.
But PrEP is about prevention.
PrEP is prevention, and that is what Brittany is doing so much work about.
Yeah, and how effective, Brittany, is PrEP in reducing the transmission of HIV?
Yeah, so just like Dr. Navacruz was saying, we have daily pills we can take, and we also have a shot that can be up to every 2 months for pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP, as well. And when taken as prescribed, it's over 99.9% effective. And so it can help someone who is negative stay negative, and they may have partners that are HIV positive, but they're protecting themselves by taking the medications to help keep them negative. It does an awesome job at what it does.
All right. So then let's talk about here in Cleveland, in our region, what are the demographics that are most at risk of getting HIV today? And not only the types of people, but what regions are, I mean, are they exclusive to certain regions?
Yeah. So it's important to know that anyone that's sexually active could be at risk, right? And so that's why we talk about routine testing across the lifespan if you're sexually active, regardless of how many partner or partners you have. But statistically speaking, there are folks that are at higher risk of having it. And it tends to live in certain demographic populations. So unfortunately, young Black gay men who have sex with men are the highest likely to have it. And there can be a lot that goes into that. Cultural things, lack of testing, you know, medical mistrust, lack of access to care and to testing, and many, many things. It's not just that people just don't get tested, right? And also, across the board, our Hispanic and Latinx folks are at higher risk too, which also those demographics also have the lowest use of pre-exposure prophylaxis. So we've kind of got twofold, right? We've got these minorities that are getting higher rates of HIV, but also they don't have access or utilization of the pre-exposure prophylaxis medicine. And so we're trying to really close that gap. And so that way those folks have access to the care and the resources that they need. And there are certain zip codes statistically in the Cleveland area that are highest. On the west side, 44102 has the highest amount of new HIV infections. And so we're able to...
And that's where you do a lot of your work.
Yeah. So a few of our health centers are located there. That's where Dr. Navacruz is located out of our Detroit Shoreway office. And I'm at two of our health centers that are in 44102 throughout the week as well. Yes.
If you have questions or comments and want to participate in this conversation about PrEP and HIV and reducing the transmission and anything involving this issue, call 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. And again, our email, SOI at ideastream.org. So, Doctor, I'd love to hear kind of how does Cleveland look both historically and currently in context to the rest of the nation when it comes to HIV and kind of the prevalence of the virus?
So we are in one of the regions that is targeted by this federal push for ending the HIV epidemic because we have a prevalence rate that mirrors other big cities, not the biggest coastal cities, but we get extra resources to the Northeast Ohio area because we have a higher prevalence than baseline around the country. The Ending the Epidemic money is going to these regions called transitional grant areas, and especially then also to the Southeast United States, because that has been a great going the wrong direction, let's say,
right,
in new infections. In our area, we have about every year about 5,100 folks who are living with HIV who are our neighbors. But we also have just over 100 folks a year who are getting new diagnoses. And any one is too much, right? Like, we have the tools, we can prevent this. So we have the rates that are of big cities. And part of that is just who you bump into, because these folks are in our neighborhoods and they're
sure,
our neighbors. But we have the tools. We can do this and we can make it better for our whole community.
So I'm just curious, if someone has HIV, but then they're on medicines that reduce their viral load, you don't say that they're not HIV positive anymore,
no,
do you?
The virus remains with you,
yeah,
but your viral load level can get so low, we call it undetectable in the blood. We know it hides in other places, and if you stop taking your medicines, the viral load will go back up. But science has shown us over and over and over again, unquestionably, that undetectable equals untransmittable. If you have a neighbor or a friend or a partner or someone you're considering being in a relationship with who is on their HIV medicines and their viral load has been undetectable, the virus level is so low that they cannot transmit that virus sexually. And that helps not only our community, but it helps individual patients take back their lives and what they want to do with relationships moving forward.
And you mentioned about 100 new cases. I saw data that you provided that showed in 2022 there was about 100 new cases in Cuyahoga County. But when you have those 100 that are reported, what does that mean for the people out there who we don't know about?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good question. And I think that's where education and awareness really ties into that. So there is like a certain amount of folks that don't know their status, and that's a really good amount of folks. They recommend HIV testing at least once in your lifetime up to the age of 64. We also know our folks over 64 are having sex too. So we encourage folks to get tested as often as they need to, not just once in your lifetime. And so that comes into play with kind of what we're doing out in outreach and community. So we're looking at untraditional settings where folks are who are disproportionately affected by new HIV diagnoses to get testing out there to make it accessible, because not everyone feels comfortable going to the doctor, or they might not have insurance and know where somewhere they can go. So making it accessible and easy for folks to do is one of the big keys to get people to know their status as well.
Let's talk about stigma, because I'm sure people out there are listening and people are having sex and they want to be safe. And, you know, maybe they are in a position where they're susceptible to getting the virus. So how do people go about, if this seems like a faraway thing, you know, getting tested, and dealing with kind of the stigma that has long lived, I think, around HIV/AIDS. So what are your thoughts when it comes to that?
Yeah, so as a nurse, you can come schedule with me and come see me as a new patient to NFP. I am open and comfortable talking about all things sex, sexuality, and those things. My job is not to judge someone for what they're doing. It's to get them the help and the resources that they need. And I care that they're safe and this is consensual, right? And so, and if those things aren't, then we get them resources that they can have. If you live on the east side and the west side seems kind of far crossing the river, which I totally hear that, you can, a lot of your local health departments, there are other healthcare facilities, asking your primary care doctor about it. And so a lot of that also comes into giving patients the power to ask for that, because not a lot of providers are comfortable talking about sex. It's like this thing over here that, you know, happens, but is not a part of overall health. And we're doing a lot of work to change that landscape. But just do a quick Google. You can also do at-home testing through the mail. They send it to you. You send it back. There's a lot of modalities that folks can access to get testing that they need.
And I think that every time that we have folks get tested, for one thing, it helps the person who is testing. And for another thing, it works to help decrease stigma. Because if we all see ourselves as vulnerable, we're going to have a little more compassion for our neighbor, for our friend, when we hear that our neighbor's cousin tested positive. And it just helps to educate folks. It helps to have everyone kind of see themselves in the same boat, and that we all are subject to the same risks and rewards in any of these relationships. So by getting oneself tested, you're also helping us all move the ball forward just a little bit more.
And I would also add, I think that's such a great point, Dr. Navacruz. And I think also to reduce stigma, just like with anything, we have to talk about it. And so that goes everywhere from, you know, talking to our kids about these things so they're raised as this is a part of normal conversation, which I'm very intentional with my daughter. And also like reproductive health education in schools, and just making it a normal part of conversation really alleviates a lot of that stigma. And also when you hear comments that are not factual, they're not aligning, correcting those in a respectful manner. So that way we're not, you know, feeding the stigma and taking that away from folks.
So all of these guidelines have been developed based on everybody in the United States, average risk folks.
Sure.
Folks who are getting HIV are not necessarily doing anything outside of the norm that anyone else is doing. They just have had the bad luck to have bumped into this in the daily doings. And like we talked about, in this area, we have a prevalence of HIV. In certain zip codes, we have higher prevalence of HIV. So many of my patients, you know, it's not worth sitting there and trying to think why this happened, because it just happened. And how can we move forward, treat you, have you have a long and healthy life?
I know that the area has been getting funding and grants from the federal level. Has there been new monies pouring into the effort to reduce transmission of HIV?
Yeah, so this whole ending the HIV epidemic program is a federal program where different federal agencies, the CDC and HRSA, came together and decided to put money into it because we have the science that we just need to match up with getting it to the people. So we have gotten an Ending the HIV Epidemic grant at Neighborhood Family Practice, but so have other especially community health centers in town. So have our public health agencies in town. We have lots of resources that have poured in, and some of it is just to get testing out there, but most of it is, like Brittany was talking about, to get it to the right populations, to get it to the right places. You know, if folks are relatively low risk, but it comforts their mind to get tested over and over again, bless their hearts, let them do that. But we know that we're missing folks who really do need to get tested, but it hasn't been the top of their mind. So all of us are swimming in the same direction in this regional area, trying to get these resources applied in the best possible ways for our community.
And so, to clarify for me and for our listeners, who should be on PrEP?
So anyone who would be comforted and protected by being on PrEP should be on PrEP. It's not a particular matter of what particular things you're engaging in. We know that PrEP works to prevent HIV transmission. It doesn't prevent other transmissions of other STIs if you come up against those, but it keeps you engaged in a healthcare system where hopefully we can address some of that later. So we have found, as PrEP has rolled out, that many of our older, more educated populations are the ones who are rushing out to access it because it works terrifically, right, just like Brittany was saying. But what we're trying to do is get the word out amongst folks who aren't as connected to the healthcare system.
Well, and if you're saying that young Black gay men are the most predominant when it comes to new transmissions, and then also Black and brown folks generally, I mean, I would assume that there is an effort to get information,
yes,
out there and outreach to connect them with A, the drug and treatment generally, and maybe even a relationship with their doctors.
And that's what Brittany works a ton of when she's doing outreach events.
Take it away, Brittany.
Absolutely. This is my bread and butter, and I cozy up to it at night because I love the work that I do.
Sure.
So we are specifically working with organizations that are serving Black and brown communities. They need the resources. There also needs to be the rebuilding of the trust in healthcare systems as well, because we recognize those lived experiences. And so that's who we're working with to do testing out in the communities on weekends, in the evenings. And that's who I'm seeing a lot of folks in clinic when I see patients. And so it's having just a normal conversation of like, hey, you're negative. This is something we can do. Let's make you an appointment while you're here to come mm-hmm. get started. And so that is absolutely the work that we're doing, because those are the under-resourced areas and the underserved. And they're our neighbors, as Lisa has said. They are organizations right down the street. They are the folks that, you know, we call to have meetings with to get testing set up, and they're the ones that we need to focus on the most to help them the most and protect them.
And the cost of PrEP, I mean, and what does that mean for someone who is interested in protecting themselves, but you know, medicines are expensive.
Yeah,
or they can be.
They can be. So we have programs. Theoretically, no one should have to pay for PrEP, whether that's pills or injections. And so we have programs to help folks who have no insurance get PrEP covered at free. We also have copay assistance programs for folks to cover the cost of really costly injectables and name brand drugs. So they're not paying anything for that. And these are conversations we're having with patients. Folks who are on Medicaid, it's covered at 100%. The state of Ohio also has a program called PAPI, P-A-P-I, and they are able to cover the additional lab costs, the doctor's visits, the nurse visits. They don't cover the medication itself, but since we have these other kind of like payer of last resorts to catch the cost of things, it should be accessible to everybody who wants it.
I'm going to close out with an email from DL. I don't know if you all can answer this, but I think it's important to bring up as a thought on one of our listeners' minds. DL writes, what's the status of fighting the criminality of not disclosing your HIV status to a sexual partner in Ohio? Is that something?
So there is a lot of work going on to change that. That is a state law in Ohio, that non-disclosure is punishable by law. There are some fabulous folks. One of our local folks working really hard on this is Dr. Barb Gripshover over at University Hospitals, and they are trying to rewrite those laws. Those laws are antiquated, they don't keep up with the science, and they need to be revised. there's folks who are working on it. I can't speak specifically about how far along it is, but I know that they've been working on that for a couple of years.
And lastly, you have 30 seconds to answer, Doctor. I've read around and seen a lot of cities that have a 2030 goal as you know, like an end line to end new HIV transmissions. Is that something that we're trying to do here?
That's the national goal. That's what the Ending the Epidemic program is trying to do by putting resources out all over the community. So we're trying real, real hard. That's soon.
Yeah.
But we're trying real, real hard. We have the tools.
Yeah. I saw Hong Kong, Sydney, and I guess in our city here, 2030 seems to be that big date. So thank you for the work that you do. Dr. Lisa Navarcruz, HIV Primary Care Program Director at Neighborhood Family Practice, and Brittany Flory, an HIV prevention nurse at Neighborhood Family Practice. I appreciate both of your time and a very important conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Of course. Time now to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about testing for fentanyl, especially in emergency situations, and why such screening is not readily available. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. The opioid overdose epidemic has had a devastating impact on our state. Last year, nearly 5,000 drug overdose deaths were recorded by the Ohio Department of Health. The synthetic opioid fentanyl figures prominently in those deaths. Fentanyl is 50 times stronger than heroin, and it's increasingly showing up in other street drugs, helping to drive accidental overdoses. In a new perspective piece in the New England Journal of Medicine, a Cleveland Clinic doctor and his co-author call for easier fentanyl testing, especially in emergency care situations. Dr. Brian Barnett is an addiction specialist and a psychiatrist with the Cleveland Clinic's Behavioral Health Department, as well as an assistant professor of psychiatry. Dr. Barnett joins me by phone. Doctor, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for your piece and for joining me this morning. And if you'd like to join the conversation, call 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Dr. Barnett, most people, I think, would assume that testing for fentanyl is already in place, especially in emergency rooms and hospitals, but that is not the case. So tell us why.
Yeah, that was one of the big motivators when we wrote this piece was to let the general public know that this is an ongoing challenge. And a big part of the reason is due to regulation. There are a lot of restrictions on what hospital laboratories are able to do. And so there are, you know, fentanyl test strips that are already available to the general public. You can, you know, check your own drugs. Those are legal in Ohio. But those have never been put through the FDA for formal approval, so hospitals can't use them. And as a result, the fentanyl tests that are typically used in hospitals have to be sent out because they're pretty complex laboratory-based tests. And so it can take a day or even several days, depending on what contractor you use to get your results back. And that creates huge problems because you know, for most patients, the results probably aren't going to be very useful at that point. The patient has already left the hospital, especially if it's an emergency room, they've come in for an overdose. And so there's not an opportunity for healthcare providers to have that discussion with patients to let them know that they've been exposed to fentanyl, because many patients are exposed to this and they're not aware of it. And then the other challenge is that many healthcare providers are actually not aware that a standard urine drug screen actually does not detect fentanyl. So it will detect opiates such as heroin, anything that breaks down into morphine. However, fentanyl is a synthetic drug, and so its chemical structure is not related to morphine. So it will not show up on those tests.
So that's interesting to me because you hear, at least, you know, as a journalist, anecdotally, I've heard of incidents when police officers even touch fentanyl and have gone into overdose and examples like that, the immediacy of the effects of fentanyl. So is fentanyl, can it vary in its strength? Are there different types of fentanyl, or is it kind of one entity that we're talking about here?
Well, so there's really just one type of fentanyl. However, there are what are called designer fentanyls that can be mixed in, and these can be much stronger. So these can be things like carfentanyl. And so it's, you know, you never know what you're actually going to get on the street. And so some samples will have, you know, just pure fentanyl, and some will be a mix of things, which can create a challenge for identifying what a patient was exposed to. And so if fentanyl is not showing up, then you'd want to send the sample out for other types of fentanyls. But those are separate tests as well. So that's even more of a challenge.
So if death is a threat, and you know, it is so kind of damaging for people, why isn't there a move to kind of get all of this process moved along more quickly so that you can test for fentanyl in emergency rooms and the FDA does approve something like this?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. You know, one is that many healthcare providers are not even aware that this is an issue, and so there's not really a collective movement within healthcare to make these changes because there's just so much lack of information about the topic. Medical schools only cover addiction in their curriculum for a couple hours, whereas you might spend a couple weeks dissecting the hand in your first year of medical school, and you know, most healthcare providers will never do any sort of hand surgery. So there's a real philosophical problem in medical school right now. Fentanyl overdoses and other opioid overdoses are the number one killer of people ages 18 to 45. And so there's been a huge shift in the type of issues that we're dealing with in healthcare now. And medical school curricula are really based in the 1970s at this moment.
Wow. So really outdated in its approach, especially when it comes to the realities, as you said, of kind of the ravaging effects of drug overdose and fentanyl overdose. You know, I'm curious, how is this playing out within our state? You know, I know that rural Ohio in particular has been hit hard by the opioid epidemic. Those areas don't always have deep healthcare resources. So what options are there for those smaller systems and testing?
Well, those hospitals, you know, typically have the ability to send out tests if they order them. You know, they're probably not going to have the capability to get rapid results. But I do encourage folks listening, if they or a loved one have an overdose or, you know, some sort of issue going on after drug use where they don't know what happened, to be sure to ask in the emergency room whether you've been tested for fentanyl. Because the tests are available at all hospitals. It's just a matter of how quickly the results will come back.
Okay, and I'm curious, what about self-testing options? And how does that figure into the equation?
Yeah, so there's been some real progress on this front recently. So in Ohio, Governor DeWine, I believe back in January, signed legislation into law confirming that fentanyl test strips are legal. So in many states, those are still considered drug paraphernalia and they're illegal to be in possession of. But that's not the case in Ohio. So you can actually buy these and test your own drug supply to see if it's been adulterated with fentanyl. And we from a harm reduction perspective, we really encourage patients to do that because fentanyl is just showing up in lots of different drugs these days, in methamphetamine, in cocaine, in tablets that are being sold on the street as everything ranging from Percocet to Adderall. The other big development is that a few days after we published this piece, the FDA actually approved an over-the-counter fentanyl test that just takes a few drops of urine and can give you a preliminary result within 5 minutes as to whether you've been exposed to fentanyl or not. So that's a very exciting development. That's been 10 years in the making.
And it's something like that. I mean, now what then becomes the hurdle of now an emergency room department having a stack of those and being able to use those? It comes back to getting through the bureaucracy and making, you know, someone signing off on the approval of those of that test use.
Yeah, exactly. So that's approved for over the counter, but you know, in hospital settings, in the labs, there's a set of rules called the CLIA amendments that regulate that. So it really is an issue of regulation and bureaucracy at this point.
So what are next steps in all of this, Dr. Burnett?
Well, I think one other thing that I forgot to mention is that in the article, we do touch on a new laboratory machine that does give more rapid fentanyl results within minutes. And so that can be used in hospital labs.
Okay.
And that was approved by the FDA late last year. And so there's also just not a lot of awareness that this exists. But hospitals that don't already have rapid fentanyl tests that they've made on their own, they should look into purchasing that for their facilities.
All right, Dr. Barnett, I appreciate you shedding light on this important issue and, raising the flag and issuing a call to make fentanyl testing easier in emergency room departments. Dr. Brian Barnett of the Cleveland Clinic, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We are on Twitter @SoundOfIdeas, and you can follow me @JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll talk to some reporters who spent months investigating the state's juvenile justice system and hear about how the issues of their reporting uncovered. If you missed any portion of this program, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas. You can listen to our podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. We'll speak to you again tomorrow.